The history of the American presidency is one of accomplishments and compromises, successes and failures. Today's guest argues that the giants from both parties over the last 120 years draw a sharp contrast to the presidency of Donald Trump. He's Robert Dalek, this week on Story in the Public Square. Hello and welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Joining me every week is my great friend, G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Story in the Public Square is an effort to study, celebrate, and tell stories that matter. We do that each week by sitting down with some of the best storytellers around, historians, novelists, journalists, and more, to make sense of the big stories shaping the United States today. This week, we're joined by esteemed presidential historian Robert Dalek, whose new book, How Did We Get Here?, is a look at the presidencies from Theodore Roosevelt to Donald Trump. Professor Dalek, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
So tell us a little bit about this book. What inspired you to write it?
Well, you know, Jim, I was puzzled that Donald Trump won the presidency. After all, there have been some candidates in the past who had never run for anything before, like William Howard Taft and Herbert Hoover. He had never run for anything. Dwight Eisenhower. But the difference with Trump is that Trump had never served in any public office, you see. And of course, Eisenhower had been a storied general in World War II, and Herbert Hoover had been Secretary of Commerce throughout the 1920s, and William Howard Taft had been the Governor General of the Philippines, and then Theodore Roosevelt, Secretary of War. So they had experience of serving in some kind of public office. But Donald Trump had never run for anything and never served in any public office. And so this was a departure from what we traditionally saw in American politics. And it reminded me of what the longest serving member of the House of Representatives, Sam Rayburn. He had been the longest serving Speaker of the House. And when Kennedy appointed, John Kennedy appointed people to serve with him, Rayburn said, "I'd have a lot more confidence in these men if just once one of them had ever run for dog catcher." The attitude was, how do you do the job in public office if you've never served at all in some kind of public capacity? And that's what puzzled me about Donald Trump's election to the presidency. And so I wanted to see what was there in the past presidencies, going back to Theodore Roosevelt, that had facilitated or opened the way for someone like a Donald Trump to become president. And frankly, my sense is that the lesson I hope people will take away from this is never put in the presidency someone with no political experience. Yeah. Because not that it guarantees anything as to their performance, but at least they have a sense of what the national political culture is like. And I think it serves them and helps them to perform more effectively in the office. So that's what motivated me to write this book.
Is it oversimplifying the argument to say that a public sector resume, some sort of engagement in public affairs is an important part. It's not just about having run a big organization. It's there's something different about public service. Is that overstating it?
No, I don't think it overstates it at all, because you know, it requires a certain sensitivity to public mood. You know, there were presidents like Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, Franklin Roosevelt, all of whom had a very keen sense of what the public mood was in the country. You can't teach it to someone. I've often told students, I can't teach you how to be a politician, and I don't intend to. But the truth is that the most effective politicians have been those who had some kind of sixth sense, who had a kind of feel for it, like, you know, a natural baseball player. And there are natural politicians. Ronald Reagan was one of them. He had a kind of feel for the public mood and could bind with them, could create a kind of a connection to them. And it's essential in a democracy like ours.
So President Trump has taken to calling journalists, people like me, although not me specifically that I'm aware, enemies of the people. Talk about the relationship between the media, various media, and presidents going back to the beginning of the 20th century. And that could be a whole long discussion, but how has that relationship been characterized over the years?
Well, all presidents have a kind of tension with journalists, because journalists want to get behind the scenes. They want to get to the truth and tear away the mask that all politicians who are effective in office or running for office wear. And it's very difficult for a politician who doesn't connect with the public to create trust, credibility. And this is where I think Trump has failed most dramatically in his, and it shows up now in the polls that we're seeing in the coming election. Of course, we're still almost 4 months away from the election, but nevertheless, to have polls in which you are 10, 12, 14 points behind your opponent, it's really pretty troubling. So I think it's essential for politicians to have credibility. And a lot of people in this country do not trust politicians. They see them as devious, manipulative, which is what they have to be in order to be effective leaders. But the point is, they also have to have a quality of deception to them that is effective in making people think that they walk on water, so to speak. And it's very difficult to be a very successful national politician. You know, maybe it's easier to do it at the local level because you have a clearer feel and connection to the people you're representing. But to do it at the national level, because after all, this is a country with such variations in geography, in ethnicity, in race. It's just an extremely difficult task. After all, there are 315 million people in this country, and they come from every part of the world and from every kind of background. And how do you create consensus, which is what the most effective thing that a president, in a way, can do at the domestic level?
So this president does not appear willing or desirable or desiring to create consensus. I think that has been clear from the beginning. He has played to his base, to use that term. Why do you think he has not sought consensus, but rather has gone in a different direction in terms of divisiveness? That seems to be where he is, as opposed to seeking consensus. Why?
You know, I'm not sure, because this has puzzled me as well. Does he really want to be reelected? I have doubts about that. I mean, he hates to be called a loser. One journalist told me that Trump called him a loser. And as far as Trump is concerned, there could be little that's worse than being called a loser. And he'll hate to have that label applied to him. But on the other hand, I don't think he particularly likes the work of the presidency. I think he likes the rallies, and he likes the praise and celebration of him as some kind of exceptional human being. But to do the work of the presidency, and you know, look at what his performance adds up to. I don't know what people can point to as a record of significant achievement. And I think it will dog him forever.
You know, I've spent enough time in and around politics to know that it can be a tough business, and that people will say things, particularly in the heat of a campaign, especially a presidential campaign, that, yes, you know, some pretty sharp elbows get thrown. What has struck me in the last 3 or 4 years are the number of serious scholars of political science and historians who have been sounding the alarm about some fundamental changes. And I think it's not an overstatement to characterize what they're describing is as threats to the Republic. Do you think that the Republic is in peril?
Well, you know, I think it is, in a way, but I also have a kind of faith in its qualities to survive Donald Trump, to outlast him. Because, after all, we have decades and decades of democratic rule in the country. But, you know, what we're seeing is the demonstration of what Winston Churchill said, that democracy is the worst possible system except for all the rest. And we're seeing the underside, so to speak, of democracy with Donald Trump. He's so totally self-absorbed. He's so narcissistically preoccupied with himself and how he'll be remembered. And he says things that are absolute nonsense. He describes himself as the best president in American history.
He's done more than any other president, right?
Exactly. I mean, it's absurd. And he's better than Theodore Roosevelt, a domestic leadership of Woodrow Wilson, Franklin Roosevelt, Dwight Eisenhower, who even when he left office after 8 years, enjoyed an extraordinary amount of popularity. So it's just, but this is Donald Trump. He is so full of narcissism and self-congratulation that it really reveals how insecure the man is. But I must say it's amazing that he has the courage and the strength to run and keep running. But I think at bottom, there's something quite off base about him. And that I don't know that he's so keen to continue being president or having to take on the duties and demands of the office.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this show can be heard 4 times every weekend on Sirius XM satellite radios, Popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce Story in the Public Square with a great crew at Rhode Island PBS, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis. On most days, you can find me running the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, you can do so at JM Lutis. Joining me as he does every week in the co-host chair is my friend G. Wayne Miller, who is an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal and the author of 17 books. You can find Wayne on Twitter too, at G. Wayne Miller. And our guest this week is Robert Dallek, one of the most prolific historians of the American presidency in recent decades. His new book is How Did We Get Here? From Theodore Roosevelt to Donald Trump.
So morality has been an issue during the Trump presidency and during the election that brought him to the White House. Talk about morality over the years in terms of presidencies and in terms of presidential elections. Has it played a big role? Has it been important? And then bring us to today with our president today.
Well, you know, when it's clear, presidents want to be seen as models, as figures everybody can want to imitate. And they are supposed to hold to a higher moral standard. Now, of course, they hide from the public. For example, when Theodore Roosevelt took control of the Panama Canal route, and at the time, he denied that he had forced the Colombians to cede the territory to the United States. And he said, when we got it and were building the canal, it was to serve international commerce. He didn't talk about the fact that he was vitally concerned about having a two-ocean navy and that America's national security was a central part of what he was concerned with. But he talked instead about the larger international morality. And Woodrow Wilson, in promoting the idea that he was making the world safe for democracy and that World War I would be the war to end all wars, what could be a greater moral achievement than to have that happen? And so presidents who are most effective, they take a strong moral line. Now, even John Kennedy did, even though behind the scenes, he was having sexual relations with all sorts of women in the White House and on the campaign trail. But other presidents have been much more effective than Trump in hiding from the public their shenanigans and their transgressions, you see. But somehow or other, Trump thinks, or so it seems, that by being a bad boy or a kind of pretty casual about these moral issues, it titillates people, you see.
And hasn't journalism also changed? You mentioned John Kennedy. Of course, it's now well known that he had a number of extramarital affairs. And yes. My understanding is that the press corps at the time, at least some members were aware of this, or at least had heard rumors. But that was not reported. And today it's quite different. Has there been a shift in journalism in the media?
Without question. And there is so much more of it because of the internet and the many outlets that exist to bring current events to people, whether on television or through print journalism or the internet. So it is, it's a very different kind of journalism that we see these days. And there's not the kind of respect, so to speak, for presidents that had existed in the past. You know, I remember the anecdote about Kennedy was in a hotel suite and he came out of the bedroom in his undershorts and one of his aides said to him, Mr. President, you know, there are the journalists out here. And he said, oh, he said, these guys are not gonna rat on me or talk behind my back. I mean, he had confidence, and Reagan did too, that he could control or lead the journalists to do his bidding, see. But this is long gone, and it in many ways begins with Lyndon Johnson and the credibility gap, you see, over Vietnam, and then balloons with Richard Nixon and the whole Watergate scandal. And of course, what hammers into place is the fact that they were journalists were able to get to Nixon's tapes. And of course, the Sam Ervin Committee in the Senate was able to get to more of the truth about what Nixon was doing behind the scenes. And so it's left a residue now of feeling that presidents can't be trusted. And one of the things I think that Trump has been doing is trying to disarm those doubts. And in a sense, he's saying, you see, I don't hide anything from you. I'm casual about these things. Now, of course, he doesn't want the lawsuits to go forward about his extramarital affairs and the press. But in a way, he also understands that this titillates people, you see. I think at one level, they like the idea that you have a roué who is titillating all sorts of men in the country about how, and he even said it on that tape. He said, when you're famous, you can get any woman you want. They let you do it. And I think he sees that as a strength. Of course, there are limits to that kind of behavior. And I think he has sort of outrun the ability to convince people that they should support him in spite of his shenanigans.
You know, I'm curious, you know, President Trump has famously taken public issue with a lot of sort of expert opinion within the U.S. government, the U.S. intelligence community, U.S. military commanders, even the National Hurricane Center. Yeah. And I'm wondering, is there any precedent in American history for the commander in chief being publicly at odds with so many experts within his own government?
You know, I don't think so. And what it reminds me of is the way Joseph McCarthy of Wisconsin would operate, you see. He had no patience for expertise. And he appealed to the what the historian Richard Hofstadter once called anti-intellectualism in American life, see. And this is Trump's forte. I'm not a snob. I'm not an intellectual. I'm not some kind of academic. I'm like the guy next door to you. And that's, you know, an effective, for a while, it's an effective way to behave. But at the end of the day, people also want to see presidents as being above the ordinary and being special. After all, they are president, and we haven't had that many presidents throughout our history. And so it becomes a different role.
So Americans, and maybe most people, like lists and rankings and so forth. Who would you rate as, you know, the top three or four, the best United States presidents, and at the other end of the scale, the two or three or four worst presidents so far.
We've got about 2 minutes for that.
Okay. The best, I think, are George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, and Franklin Roosevelt. See? And the worst, I think, are James Buchanan and Warren G. Harding, and now Donald Trump. I think he will gain a place at the bottom of the list of presidents.
Do you think he's changing America, or do you think he reflects America? I guess that's the analytical balance, I suppose.
Well, I think he in part does reflect America. He never would have gotten to the presidency without some extent of that. And on the other hand, he breaks the bounds of what is acceptable. And I think historians, I guess, shouldn't predict the future, but I'll do it. my guess is that Joe Biden will not just win, but he'll win in a landslide. You know, people in this country, when they elect a president, they want something new. And so you had Theodore Roosevelt, the new nationalism, Wilson, the new freedom, Roosevelt, the new deal, Kennedy, the new frontier, Reagan, the Reagan revolution. See, and even Obama, who I know because I was one of 7 or 8 lucky historians to have dinner with him 5 times because he liked to talk to historians. Anyway, it's a changing world, and presidents need to keep up with changes. You know what they say, the only constant in history is change. And however much you know about the past, and you should know about the past, unlike Donald Trump, who went to Pearl Harbor and he didn't know what that was about. I mean, I found it appalling that he was so ignorant of our history.
Well, Professor Dalek, your book is a great antidote to that. We appreciate your joining with us. Thank you so much. He's Robert Dalek. The book again is How Did We Get Here? That's all the time we have this week, but if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter or visit pellcenter.org, where you can always catch up on previous episodes. For G. Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis, asking you to join us again next time for more Story in the Public Square.